Coming up on this week's book show, the majority of celestial space is inactive and will remain forever unruffled. But when cosmic violence does unfold, it changes the very fabric of the universe. In his new book, Earth Shattering, astronomy writer Bob Berman investigates these instances of violence, both mammoth and microscopic. Bob Berman on this week's book show. Welcome to The Book Show, a celebration of reading and writers. I'm Joe Donahue. The overwhelming majority of celestial space is inactive and will remain forever unruffled. But when cosmic violence does unfold, it changes the very fabric of the universe, with mega explosions and ripple effects that reach the near limits of human comprehension. From colliding galaxies to solar storms and gamma ray bursts to space and time warping upheavals, these moments are rare, yet powerful, often unseen but consequentially felt. In his new book, Earth Shattering, astronomy writer Bob Berman guides us through an investigation into these instances of violence, both mammoth and microscopic. Bob Berman is the author of Zapped, Zoom, and the Sun's Heartbeat. He is a columnist for Astronomy Magazine. He is the science editor of the Old Farmer's Almanac. Again, the name of the new book is Earth Shattering, and it's always a pleasure to welcome Bob Berman to the book show. How are you, Bob?
Great, Joe. Thank you.
Always a pleasure to have you on our program. So let us begin with what brought you to these things that are not necessarily common, yet very disruptive.
Well, there seemed to be a big interest, a paranoid interest, in things that could kill us all. Part of it is government conspiracies, that there are some people that think there's a planet on a collision course with us. It's imaginary. It's not real. But people believe in that. And when they hear about some other thing that does come close to us, asteroids, for example, that just barely miss us, I keep hearing the comments of, yeah, the government would lie to us. It's really going to, the world is going to end. And they say it with a certain enjoyment. So it looked like there was a real interest in this stuff.
So before we dive deep, what do you think accounts for the paranoia? What brings us to that point that, oh, this stuff can happen that is out of our control, and we seem to be kind of into that?
I think perhaps it's a combination of wanting to tie, in some way, psychologically tie our future with something bigger and grander. Even though we all know we're more likely to be done in by our own stupidity, smoking cigarettes, for example, or high cholesterol or something like that. Nonetheless, the idea that when we go, the whole planet goes, and that it's some sort of epic thing that we're going to share, and it all has meaning, and I think there's a certain appeal to that.
One of the things that I love about your writing, one of the things I love about this book, as in your past work, is that I usually don't understand astronomy generally. It's very hard. When we start talking about time and space, I just zone out. I don't get it. When I read your stuff, I get it. I understand it. At least for that moment, I have trouble maybe retaining it. But at that moment, I very much understand it. And I think that's what makes this book so revealing. You bring it down, you bring it to, I shouldn't say down, you bring it to a level that is very within our grasp. As a writer, what is it like to share that, to tell us what is going on in language that most of us can understand?
Gee, I don't know. It seems to come easily to me, just as remembering people's names and faces do not come easily to me. When I used to teach college astrophysics, I couldn't remember the names of my students, even after the end of the several months. So it's very embarrassing, but somehow numbers stick in my mind. And I love this stuff, too. Like when we're talking about the moon, and how do we know that a meteorite that's found actually came from the moon, was blasted off from the moon and is a piece of the moon? How do we know for sure? You have to get into isotope discussions. So, yes, we have to explain what an isotope is, what the isotopic ratio of the different kinds of oxygen, because we're all breathing in three different types of oxygen in the air with every breath, and how the moon has a different ratio of isotopes. And that's how, it's like a fingerprint. That's how we know that a particular thing that's landed on Earth came from Mars or an asteroid or the moon. It's like, it's for sure. So you got to understand this, and I think it's interesting.
Let's talk about cosmic violence then. So when it comes to that, how do we know what is going on has gone on? Like, how ultimately do we find out about it?
Well, with the violence that's personally affected our planet, that's kind of easy because there are impacts and there are records in the geological record. And some of them were very cool to find out, like when the Walter and Luis Alvarez discovered how the dinosaurs were done in by a giant impactor, either a comet or an asteroid. Whatever hits us is always called a meteor, and then pieces are a meteorite, regardless of what it really was in space. So that was a big, big thing. But how do you know? Well, in their case, it turned out that the stuff created dust that settled all around the world. And no matter where you are in the world, you can see in highway cutouts on the mountainsides, there's a change in the color of the rock from 66 million years ago. And that layer has enhanced iridium, which is a rare atom, a rare element here on Earth, but it's common in comets and in asteroids. So this enhanced iridium layer, just at the time when the dinosaurs died out, was proof. And so it's rare when you get anything that's nailed, but they nailed it.
So right now, could there be cosmic violence going on right this moment as we speak?
Oh, there is. Of course there is. I mean, all the cosmic rays that are going through our bodies, 240 muons, for example, are penetrating each of our bodies every second. And they largely come from, especially the fast ones, they come from cosmic violence. It's the only way. They come from supernova explosions. Some of them come from things interacting with black holes. And so we know it's happening because it comes here. It actually penetrates our bedrooms and our bodies. Nothing sacred. It just flies throughout the universe and leaves evidence for its presence.
So what is the evidence that it leaves within us?
In some cases, it's harmless. Like even though 4 trillion neutrinos fly through each of our eyeballs per second, and that comes from pretty violent processes inside stars, including the sun, nothing stops them. It's interesting that at night, we get just as many neutrinos penetrating our bodies when the sun is not out than in the daytime, because those neutrinos have passed through the whole planet Earth in about a 20th of a second, as if the Earth were made of fog. Nothing. Doesn't even slow them down. And then enters us from our feet, going upward through our bodies, through our brains, and then exits us. Just the same number as in the day when the sun is over our head. So, but that doesn't interact with normal baryonic matter, meaning the atoms and molecules in our bodies. But the muons, those, Joe, that are penetrating us all the time, they'll occasionally hit the wrong bit of genetic material in a cell nucleus, in a gene, and they're responsible for some of the unfortunate tumors that have always plagued the human race. It's not an abstraction if you're actually going to die because of faraway violence, and that really does happen.
How do you prove that? I mean, is a doctor going to come down and say to you, well, this ray came in and hit your heart?
Not if he's working for an insurance company. He's not going
okay.
to. But no, because many tumors don't have a, there's no tag that's saying here's why this gene was mutated, because we don't know what caused the original disruption in the gene, in our DNA or in anything else. It could have been anything. But knowing that there's a certain background radiation, something in the order of 308 millirems a year. And knowing that these cosmic rays, they're measurable, are coming into our bodies all the time, you just put two and two together and there's no question about it. Although recent evidence is seeming to indicate that maybe a small amount of radiation is actually good for us, that we may have to rethink whether this stuff is bad or actually helpful.
And the health benefits would be kind of killing the bad stuff, right?
Well, it's something called radiation hormesis, which when people exposed to low amounts of radiation, we're talking about Hiroshima and Nagasaki and Chernobyl survivors and people who live in India near this radioactive thorium-contaminated white sand beach in Kerala in India, these people were studied for decades, and instead of a certain increased cancer rate among them, the cancer rate was no more than that of a general population, and in some cases was less than people who didn't have this little bit of extra radiation. And this has caused more and more researchers to believe that a small amount of radiation kind of primes you or hardens you or lets your body repair itself and sets yourself up to be able to better resist a larger cancer insult or radiation insult in the future. And if that's true, and it's looking more and more like it's true, people can look up radiation hormesis and see this. It means that maybe going to Mars, where any future astronauts would be exposed to more radiation, might be just fine. And it may mean that those dental x-rays that many of us have been afraid of getting, maybe they're absolutely fine to get.
The name of the book is Earth-Shattering, Violent Supernovas, Galactic Explosions, Biological Mayhem, Nuclear Meltdowns, and Other Hazards to Life in Our Universe. The book is published by Little Brown. Bob Berman is our guest on this week's book show. You write a lot about Chicago. Was that natural, or did that just sort of coincidence?
Well, it's coincidence because some of the experts who brought us our stories about this violence came from Chicago. The Alvarez people, Walter and Luis, were University of Chicago researchers. Edwin Hubble was a Chicagoan. You wouldn't have known that because of his fake British accent that drove everyone crazy all the time, but he was from Chicago. So parts of our story keep coming back to that city.
You have a chapter in which Chicago is related, but the chapter is titled The Greatest Mass Extinction. What happened there?
Well, the great one was the Permian Age extinction, 251 million years ago. And because that killed the most creatures and it did the most disruption and caused extinctions of creatures that had been around for at least tens of millions of years. The trilobites, those lovable trilobites that we all have fossils of. Well, I do at home. They were gone after that. That's the most puzzling of them all, because in this particular case, we don't even know. Because unlike the KT extinction of 66 million years ago, this one, much earlier, there's no one clear-cut cause. It could have been what's called the Siberian Traps, which is an odd name for a series of mega volcanoes that were erupting at that time. It could have been something in the sea, a sea like a bloom of organisms in the ocean that's changed the Earth, and their effluence changed the entire planet. It could have been that plus an impact. Odd that we don't know what caused the greatest destruction and loss of life in our planet. But that was the one, the most mysterious.
I find that fascinating. You write in the book on that very subject, 90% of all species vanished. Creatures like the lovable trilobites, as you mentioned, that had been around since forever vanished. More than 95% of the things in the oceans died. So did the forests and the insects. Not even one in three land species survived. And recovery was interminably delayed. It was just too hot. And we can only guess why it happened, you write. And that is what I want to focus on for a moment. In science, in your field, there's still a ton of stuff we don't know, isn't there?
Oh, sure. Sometimes I think that what we don't know is like a blizzard compared to the single snowflake of what we do know. And sometimes we have a handle on the rough ideas, but not the specifics. In fact, it ties into what could be a permanent extinction being set up right now. The Holocene, so-called a fifth extinction event, is it really underway? Is the stuff that we're doing to the planet right now in terms of rainforest defoliation and climate change and habitat loss and all the things that humans are doing, we are certainly changing the planet. We're certainly wiping out creatures at a much higher rate. And yet we're not sure. And this is what, unfortunately, some people grab onto and say, well, how do we know that's real? We know things are happening and they're not good. But will they ultimately be good? Because every past great cataclysmic event ended up being more good than bad. And so will the present thing that we're doing, it's certainly not nothing. And the people who think, no, climate change is a hoax, it's of course not true. But how bad is it going to be? Is it going to be something we adapt to and turns out to be we can kind of brush it off? Or is this going to be one of the big ones that belongs in this book?
You talk in this book of upcoming cataclysms. You say they're not over, they're never over, as long as several major religions predict that the world will end, not with a whimper, but a bang, we'll have millions watching for signs. Okay, religion aside, what should we be watching for?
That goes in two categories, Joe. One category are the things that really are going to happen and cause, well, ultimately the planet to be destroyed. The planet will be destroyed in probably 1.1 billion years, but will something happen before that? The other main category are the things that people believe will happen. When Earth went through the tail of Halley's Comet in 1912, and the comets had been known to have
cyanide, right?
Yeah, cyanogen in the tail. And so there was widespread, no, this was based on some science, that it would poison the atmosphere and cause all life to go extinct on Earth. And in our own lifetimes, we remember Y2K and the silly ones like the Mayan calendar business in 2012.
Right. So all the planets were going to line up and we were going to be toast.
That's right. That was the Jupiter effect,
right,
back in 1982 when California was supposedly going to break into the sea. That's the other thing. The ones that people think are going to do us in but never end up doing that. And those, I did a little research and I found that they all have a pattern, and we could predict the future ones that people are going to believe will be the end of the world, the ones that are coming up in the next 20, 30, 40 years. We can see them coming clearly.
How worried should we be? I mean, if we read your book, should we be comforted or should we be worried?
Good question. I would say not to be worried, considering that bad things have happened before and they've produced more good than bad in the long term. On the other hand, we're certainly going to be clobbered. Meteors are going to strike us, big ones again. There will be future mass extinctions, and ultimately the Earth will be destroyed in 1.1 billion years. So if you think long term, there's no hope for the planet long term. Our lifetimes? Nah, I wouldn't worry about it.
All right. What about science in general? Where are we with just science in general? I worry that we tend to dismiss it. I worry that we tend not to pay attention to it, often because we can't completely understand it. And then people will often say, well, this study says this, but that study says that, so you really can't believe any of it. And I'm wondering, for folks in your field, look at the space program is practically dormant at this point. Are we doing enough to understand and to fill in all of those blanks that you mentioned a few moments ago, that blizzard of material that we don't know?
There'll always be the unknown. And are we doing enough? You know, people have different pots that are cooking in different areas of science, and everybody wants to have more studies in the area that they're most fascinated with. You could argue that cancer research is far more important than landing humans on Mars and
right,
will affect more people. So there's different ways to look at it. Science is the best tool we have. There's no question about it. It's unfortunate that thanks to the web and perhaps paranoia and perhaps greed and other reasons, that there are put downs of science based on ambiguity, because there's always going to be aspects of any science that are either contradictory or incomplete. And if you want absolute certainty, with like an infant does, where everything is either yes or no, or I hate it or I love it, and there's no in between or gray areas, you have come to the wrong planet, really, because we're never going to have certainty in all our areas. I mean, there's a few certain things. We know water boils at 212 degrees Fahrenheit, and that's not going to change, although it does change if you go up a hill, then it'll boil a degree sooner every 500 feet higher. You know, around places around here that are hilly or mountainous, you go up 1,000 feet, you're not going to have coffee as hot as it is down in, let's say, Kingston or New York City. So I guess there's ambiguity everywhere.
In that ambiguity and what you're writing about in this book of this violence that takes place, what surprised you? What did you find to string this narrative together to say, okay, these are the things that are happening and this is the context we should put this in?
I'd say some of the biological cataclysms fit that category. I wanted to not get into every epidemic and plague, but set a limit of 2% of the world's population had to be killed by a biological event for it to be counted as a cataclysm. And so it was obvious that the plagues belonged there. And what I was surprised, you asked me what surprised me, I was surprised that there was a clockwork thing with the plague. I had no idea before I researched this that once a ship full of infected rats reached a port, that the first human deaths were always 23 days later, almost like somebody had set an egg timer. And that's how long it took the local rats to be infected and people to start to be bitten. And then there was about a half week incubation period once a person had been bitten by an infected flea. So it was a 23-day clock. I had no idea about that. I didn't know that the Spanish flu was from 1918, produced the effects that it had, that it was an H1N1 virus, a common virus that we get every winter, and that it could have been so virulent just that one time. And why did that happen? So we get into that. So there were surprises here and there, nuclear power plants and how radiation actually goes awry at our own power plants. That surprised me, too, in some ways.
Let's talk about that for a second, because when it comes to nuclear meltdowns, I mean, that is within our control, right?
Yes. Overall, yes. And the reason I'm hesitating is because the Fukushima so-called disaster, I hate to use that word disaster because nobody was killed. Nobody. But we use the word disaster for that. The real disaster was the tsunami caused by the earthquake earlier that day. That killed a lot of people. But the nuclear power, and that was within our control because 18 other power plants throughout Japan were also struck by this record earthquake earlier that afternoon, and every one of them safely were able to go to full cold shutdowns with no problems whatsoever. So why did this one power plant, this one reactor at this one power plant, why was that a problem? So in some cases, as you say, it is a human factor that changed what would have been a big nothing so far as nuclear danger that day into the big scare and problem that it was. And it was a single person, engineer at that plant, who thought the power plant was cooling too quickly. So he disabled a few switches, shut off a couple of pumps, and he didn't let the automatic system do its work. And that single operator caused all that, the damage, the loss of a perfectly good nuclear power plant that day. So, yeah, sometimes it's a very simple cause.
I mean, if you think about the galactic explosions that you talk about in the book, or a violent supernova, those are things that we can't control, and those are things that are ultimately happening to us. Whereas in a nuclear meltdown, well, obviously that is something that we have done, that we have created, that is altering life on the planet.
Quite true. And some of these, even if we know about them, we're not going to make a change. For example, nuclear weapons, many of us think H-bombs are a lot worse than atomic bombs, like the first couple of were atomic bombs. And it turns out that very quickly, and we're talking about the early 50s, scientists learned that they could make a far more powerful explosion if they wrapped the entire bomb casing in ordinary, the most common type of uranium, not even enriched uranium, uranium-235, but used ordinary cheap U-238. And that would actually fission where it normally wouldn't. It would fission if it were receiving fast neutrons from an interior atomic bomb and hydrogen bomb within it. But the problem there is this is very dirty. It increases the yield, but creates a lot of fallout. And if there is ever a nuclear war, the planet is going to be super irradiated just thanks to the design of having the casing of these uranium casings surrounding the bombs. And it didn't have to be that way. When Russia shot off its greatest nuclear weapon, a 50 megaton, what's called the Tsar Bomba, it was clean. It was the greatest atomic explosion ever, the greatest explosion on Earth ever, and it was clean. It produced very little radiation. So you can get a blast with very little polluting effects, but that's not what we did. So the nuclear weapons, as designed, are going to be catastrophic if they're ever used in a nuclear war. That's what would be within our power to change, but nobody's going to change that.
You have a chapter in here called That Thermonuclear Business. One of the things that I took away from that chapter, and correct me if I misread it, is that basically fallout shelters aren't going to help you.
You took that away? No, I mean, 2 weeks is all you really need.
Is that right?
For that. Yeah, because radiation loses its potency at a predictable rate. So the first 2 days are really bad. But after 2 weeks, the radiation is down to a level no matter what it started out at.
But can you hide from it? It seemed like it was all encompassing. It didn't seem like you could hide from it.
You can hide from it if you have an air cleaning system, which I've noticed online are being sold. Some of them are hand cranked, some are battery operated. But if you had a shelter that could clean the air in your basement, that's the key, and stored enough bottles of water, you could survive that.
Yeah, I guess I'm thinking, my takeaway is that you have that dusty old town garage where you took your DMV test that had the fallout shelter sign. It seemed like if you were there, you're screwed.
Yeah, that you'd be screwed. You need something better than that. All of those fallout shelters with all those signs, those yellow and black signs from the 50s, unfortunately, all the government did back then was put signs up. None of them had water, even. None of them had air scrubbing devices in it. For $2,000, you could have an air scrubber that actually, that's the big danger. Not only cleans the fallout from the air before bringing it in, but overpressures your basement so that if there are any leaks in your house, which there will be through windows or cracks in the foundation, the leak will be from inside out. You're going to have a little more air pressure inside than out, and so nothing bad from outside will come in. And people could do that for a couple $1,000s if they wanted to.
The name of the book is Earth Shattering: Violent Supernovas, Galactic Explosions, Biological Mayhem, Nuclear Meltdowns, and Other Hazards to Life in Our Universe. The book is published by Little Brown. Bob Berman, it's always a pleasure to have you on the program.
Joe, the pleasure is mine. Thank you.
Thank you very much. We enjoy hearing from our listeners about our shows. You can email us at book@wamc.org, and you can listen again to this or find past book shows via podcast or at wamc.org. Sarah LaDuke produces our program. Bookmark us for next week. And thanks for listening for The Book Show. I'm Joe Donahue.